Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. In a couple of weeks, we're going to do something new on the podcast. We're going to discuss and answer listeners' questions that they have emailed into me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. I'm excited to hear more comments from our listeners and subscribers. But in the next couple of weeks, we're going to listen to a 1966 interview with Penn Jones Jr. done on KPFA Radio out of Hollywood, California. You may ask why I'm spending so much time talking about Penn Jones Jr. Not only was he sort of a grandfather to JFK assassination researchers, but also my hero in the research community. So many people back in his day did not want to hear what Penn had to say, and I think it's important that his voice be heard, even if it is 25 years after his death. If Penn had only known back then what we know now, oh boy. The introduction to this interview is from well-known assassination researcher and author James D. Eugenio. I have made it well-known in my podcast my admiration for Penn Jones Jr., so I wanted you to hear this introduction by Mr. D. Eugenio and to hear what another researcher thinks of Penn and his research into the JFK assassination. What you're about to hear is a very rare interview with Penn done on September 26, 1966 on KPFA Radio. He is interviewed here by William O'Connell. Keep in mind that it was very unpopular back in 1966 when this interview was done to speak about disbelief in the Warren Commission's report. The discussion in this interview is about his book, Forgive My Grief, which was an examination of the Warren Commission's study of President Kennedy's assassination. This was a very important interview. Just so you won't be confused, when this interview was conducted, Jack Ruby was still alive, rotting away in a Dallas jail cell after his shooting of Lee Harvey Oswald. During the 6 months following the Kennedy assassination, Ruby repeatedly asked to speak to members of the Warren Commission. The commission initially showed no interest, but Ruby's sister Eileen wrote letters to the commission, and her letters became public. When that happened, the commission then agreed to talk to Ruby. You will hear Penn Jones Jr. speak about Ruby in this interview. Hope you enjoy part one of this interview.
We're here with James D. Eugenio. He is the publisher at KennedysandKing.com and the author of The JFK Assassination, The Evidence Today. Thank you, Jim, for talking to us.
Okay, you're welcome, David.
We got a KPFA interview from 1966 with Penn Jones Jr. He's talking about his first book. And Jim, you had a chance to listen to it. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about Penn Jones and the work that he did on the assassination.
That was actually a pretty interesting interview. See, Penn Jones is one of these guys from Texas who actually bought a weekly newspaper before the assassination. And he talks about it in that interview. All right. He had owned it for a year or two before the assassination. It had been firebombed. And I don't know if he makes his connection, but he had refused to do a printing for this right-wing group that I think was led by one of the Texas police officers, Mr. Butler. And because they were associated with the extreme right, the Klan, and the John Birch Society, all right, and Penn did not really find that all attractive, even though he would have made a lot of money if he would have done the printing assignment for him. Now, one of the things that Penn talks about also in there is the difference between how many people have read the Warren Report versus how many people have read the 26 volumes, which, of course, is the commission, what they call the testimony and exhibits. Because as he notes in there, if you read the testimony and exhibits, you'll see that it does not match up with what's in the 888-page Warren Report. Unfortunately, not very many people want to read the testimony exhibits because it's about 17,000 or 18,000 pages in those 26 volumes. All right. Penn also talks about, I think it's an interesting question he's talking about here, is when he talks about the difference in the books coming out at around this time and how they differ from the stuff that was being written back in 1964. If you recall, in 1964, when the Warren Report first came out, there were not really that many voices, okay, that were talking about the problems with the evidence, okay, at that time. There was maybe Mark Lane in The Guardian, Staunton Lind in The New Republic, and I think there was also a column by the French writer whose name I can't recall right now. Louis Sauvage. And that was really about it at that time. What happened, of course, is that some people actually did read the 26 volumes. And in one case, Edward Epstein, he actually had access to a lot of the people who actually worked on the Warren Commission, especially Wesley Liebler. Right. And so in his book, Inquest, which came out in 1966, that book sort of took you inside the Warren Commission and how it worked. And it showed you how a hierarchy, all right, can essentially veto the wishes of the people working under it. Because in that book, for example, he shows how certain lawyers on the commission did not want to include some of the most controversial witnesses that ended up in the Warren Commission report, like Howard Brennan and Helen Markham. The lower level, what they call junior counsel, objected to including them in the Warren report. Wesley Liebler for one, Joseph Ball for another one. Wesley Liebler in his famous memorandum, the Liebler memorandum, said it was a nice try trying to bury Helen Markham, but I predict she will not be hidden for long. Okay. And then Joseph Ball at a debate, I think, in Long Beach, he called her, quote, an utter screwball. All right. So in other words, there were people inside the Warren Commission who understood that the critics were going to have an open season on some of the people they decided to use. And of course, that happened with Mark Lane, because Mark Lane, he came out with his book, Rush to Judgment, and he went after both of those people. OK, showing what unreliable witnesses that they actually were, all the serious problems that they exposed. Now, in Penn's books, Forgive My Grief, I think, just came out at this time, and I believe they did 3 or 4 volumes of that. Penn Jones's book was a little bit different in that he was one of the few critics who actually inserted long chunks of testimony to show how absurd the Warren Commission conclusions really were. And another thing he did, and the interviewer noticed this also, he was one of the first to point out the rather odd occurrence of these, let's call them untimely deaths, and how this had put a fear into some of the witnesses. In the interview, he mentions Lee Bowers, you know, how his wife did not want to talk about his death, but she did say that he had been instructed not to talk to the public, although he did talk to Mark Lane, all right, for his video. But I can tell you that other people encountered this very serious problem also. Emil D'Antonio, when he was shooting the Rush to Judgment video with Lane, said he had never seen this kind of fear in any documentary film that he had done. And he had done one on McCarthy, okay, and he did one on Vietnam. And he said, I never encountered so many frightened witnesses as I did in shooting that film with Mark Lane. Never. And he talked a little bit about Helen Markham, how she was afraid to even come outside of her door. All right, this is the person that the Warren Commission used to make their case for Oswald killing Tippit. And we got that also from Vincent Salandria, who's another guy who went down to Dallas, I believe, in the summer of 1964. And he told me more or less the same thing. That somebody he thought was a Dallas police was intimidating these witnesses. And I have it from a third source also, a report journalist who tried to interview some of the people working at Texas School Book Depository. And he said that the Dallas police essentially rode him out of town. Okay, when he started talking to some of the people who worked at the Texas School Book Depository. So that's another theme that he hits upon. And see, the thing is, because he lived 25 miles away, Penn Jones, I believe, was the first guy to actually begin what he called the annual vigil, okay, in which he would go ahead, drive up to Dallas, all right, and stage a commemoration for Kennedy's death on every November 22nd, 1963. And over time, as this went on, in the 1966, 1967, when the big controversy is hitting the airwaves, this began to attract some attention. And I'm not just talking about other people in Dallas. I'm talking about some of the, if you can believe it, some of the mainstream press now began going down there. Penn Jones actually met up with Martin Waldron from the New York Times, okay, at the November 22nd, 1966 commemoration. And Waldron had a lot of questions for him. This shows, by the way, the very fact that that happened shows that the mainstream media, contrary to what they said, was very interested in the JFK case. And what Penn said at that time was that a lot of the questions that Waldron had for him dealt with New Orleans. And by the way, same thing with Life magazine. All right. Their investigation, when it got into New Orleans, began to sputter. All right. And be sidetracked. Because there were a lot of connecting, interesting parts in the whole New Orleans nexus of the Kennedy assassination. That's another thing Penn did. Penn started those annual commemorations that go on until this very day. Now, another thing that Penn brings up in this interview that I found to be quite interesting is the death of Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen was, of course, one of the very, very few reporters for a big newspaper. I think it was a New York Journal American. And she made no bones about how interested she was in the Kennedy assassination. She actually wrote a few columns about the JFK case. And as he mentions in the interview, during the Jack Ruby trial, which she covered, because she was very interested in high-profile murder cases. For instance, she covered the Sam Shepard murder trial also. And so she went down, and her editor let her go down there and cover the Jack Ruby trial. And I'm pretty sure she's the only person who was allowed to get a private interview with Ruby and also get an interview with the judge, okay, during that trial. And there was a very good article, a long article about her death. It was in the Midwest Book Review. And it's a very good article about the odd circumstances around Dorothy Kilgallen's strange death. And she was supposedly, from the word of the people who were around her, okay, she was going to take a trip to New Orleans at around the time, I think she died in 1966. Her biographer, Lee Israel, there were a lot of interesting things that she cut from her biography of Kilgallen. It's very interesting that he's onto that, the whole Dorothy Kilgallen angle, this early in the case. Okay, that's really speaks well, you know, for Penn Jones, because this is something, of course, that people still have not actually gotten onto. Okay, that the Kilgallen death was both very interesting in its circumstances and also probably important to the case itself. Now, Penn was in an interesting position because he had bought this newspaper, the Midlothian Mirror, in this small town. He was the editor and publisher of that newspaper. So in other words, he didn't have to answer to anybody. And so it was a weekly newspaper, which he brought out. I met his wife once, and she told me how they worked together on it. And Penn almost always insisted on putting at least one article in there about the JFK case. He was really, I can't think of another person who did that. There was no newspaper in America that did what Penn, you know, usually it was the other way around. The major newspapers frowned on anything relating to the JFK case. Now, Penn Jones was also, I think most people listening to this show will understand. Once the Jim Garrison investigation went public in February of 1967, very soon after that, the critics were split about their feelings about Garrison. Okay. You had people who were vociferously against him, like Sylvia Marr and Paul Hoke, Peter Dale Scott, Tink Thompson. All right. And then you had other people who were for him, like Ray Marcus, Mark Lane, and Penn Jones was another one. Penn Jones never lost faith in Jim Garrison. And there was an interesting exchange of letters between Penn Jones and Sylvia Marr over this dispute. It's in John Kellen's very good book, Praise from a Future Generation, which details the lives of the early critics from about 1965 to about 1968. Penn Jones never lost his loyalty to Jim Garrison, and I think that also speaks very well of Penn. And by the way, I have to say this, he never lost his interest in this case. Okay, up until when he died, he was still active in this case. And you know, the JFK, I've learned the hard way. The JFK case is not a winner, okay? In any way, shape, or form. I mean, it even hurt somebody as big as Oliver Stone, right? You know, if you talk to him, he'll tell you that JFK did not help his career. It actually hurt his career, all right? Because he was attacked so vociferously. I think we all remember that. I mean, if you were around in 1991, the attacks on Oliver Stone began 6 or 7 months before the picture ever premiered in the theaters. But Penn Jones was on this case for, oh my God, 3 decades, all right? Of course, it didn't help him. It didn't help his newspaper. It didn't help him financially or anything like that. But I have to admire the guy's guts and perseverance. One last thing I want to say about Penn. In addition to the Midlothian Mirror, okay, in addition to his books, he published one of the most distinguished JFK research journals I think ever existed. And this was called The Continuing Inquiry. And if you want to read some good writing, and I think it was from the 70s and the 80s, that collection, you can read it online at the Mary Farrow Foundation. That website has the past issues. And you will see some very good writing from people who were still interested in the JFK case. Penn edited that, okay, contributed some of the articles himself, all right? And it had some of the best writers from that era, like Ed Tatro, for example, out of Massachusetts. So that's another contribution that this guy made to this case, okay? I mean, Penn Jones, you got to really consider when you take a look at him, you know, and everything he tried to do in this case, which, like I said, did not benefit him in any way. Fame, money, fortune, and anger. Forget it. All right. But he did it and he kept his nose to the grindstone, even though it hurt him probably. And there's at least one article by Ron Rosenbaum in the Texas Monthly that actually went after Penn Jones. This is what I mean. Okay. The big guns of the media will go after you if you stay on this case too long. You know, that got Ron Rosenbaum a spot on Nightline with Ted Koppel. Okay, in which Texas Monthly has been just horrible on the JFK case forever. All right, there's essentially the Texas establishment. Penn Jones, by the way, one very last thing. I believe that those annual commemorations, okay, that he had, which got bigger and bigger as time went on, I believe that what happened there is that he kind of forced the power elite in Dallas to face the fact that Dealey Plaza was their number one tourist site. That people were just going there month after month, year after year, because they wanted to see the place where John F. Kennedy was killed, you know? And I think Penn helped contribute to that until finally they decided that, okay, we're going to have to take control of this situation, all right? And so then I think in late 89 or something like that, they decided they were going to construct the Sixth Floor Museum, okay, out of the old Texas School Book Depository. That's the kind of impact that one guy had, Penn Jones, okay, on this case. All right, a very admirable person, and this is a good interview.
I'm Lee McConnell, and we have in the studio with us today Penn Jones Jr., the author of a new book on the Kennedy assassination entitled Forgive My Grief. It's subtitled A Critical Review of the Warren Commission Report on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Mr. Jones is here in California for a few days, and this isn't my first opportunity to talk with him. As a matter of fact, I didn't know him at all. I had read his book, and I happened to be in Houston on business just a few weeks ago, and having been an independent researcher on the case for a couple of years, I was very anxious to meet you, and as you may recall, I phoned you, and you were very cordial and appreciative of my interest, and then I came up to Dallas, and Mr. Jones took me around the assassination site for 2 days, and we retraced some of the steps allegedly taken or followed by Lee Harvey Oswald. We went to the Tippit site, and this visit enabled me to make a photographic record for my own purposes of the site, and I only wish I could have stayed longer.
We do too, Ben.
Thank you so much. I notice in your book that you have an introduction by John Howard Griffin, and he says a number of interesting things here. I wonder if I could... I want to lead up to a number of questions. He says some few men in this country were not satisfied with these loose ends. He's referring to a number of loose ends with reference to stories concerning the assassination.
Yes.
He continues, he said some of these had obsessive theories and tried to make the loose ends arrange themselves in such a way as to prove these theories. They do not count for anything. Others, however, with a great dedication to truth, wherever it might lead them, have sought to resolve these loose ends for the sake of history and truth. They have devoted themselves to gathering, sifting, and re-examining evidence. They've sought to follow truth even when this has led them down roads that sickened and terrified them. Penn Jones belongs to this latter small group. Since that terrible day, he has dedicated himself to resolving the riddle, and he has followed authentic leads, abandoned countless ones that turned out not to be authentic. He asks, is this wise to do this? I want to ask that question of you, Mr. Jones. Is it wise? And if so, why?
Well, I think it may not be wise, but it's necessary, Bill. The people of the United States must be aware of the things that went on in Dallas, the things that went on even before the assassination. And they must acquaint themselves with the testimony and the exhibits of the Warren Commission. You know, Bill, there have been less than 2,000 sets of the testimony and exhibits sold in the United States.
You're referring to the 26 volumes,
aren't you? Yes, the 26 volumes. Certainly there were millions of copies of the report sold, and I'd say that thousands of people have read the report. But I dare say there are less than 500 people in the United States, probably less than 200 people in the United States, who have read a major portion of the testimony and the exhibits.
It's very time-consuming. I know I have a set of my own, and it's very demanding.
Well, it's true that there are 18,000 pages. There are over 10 million words, but this democracy is worth that effort. This democracy is worth our dying for, if necessary. And I think we must dig to the very bottom of this thing,
well,
regardless.
A number of people are now digging to the bottom, as you say. And we have a spate of books on the Warren Commission report that are now appearing. And yours came to me, as a matter of fact, before the first of these, which I believe was Inquest by Edward J. Epstein. And I read it. I read your book at that time. That was before I met you, and I've been looking through it again. One of the questions that many people ask is, how responsible is the criticism that's now being leveled at the Warren Commission? Some people construe it as an attack upon the person of the Chief Justice of the United States. How would you reply to that?
Bill, I'm a newspaper man. I own my own little weekly newspaper in Midlothian, Texas. Now, that's not in Dallas. It's 25 miles south of Dallas.
Yes.
And I am trying, as a newsman, to do an honest job. News stories are written and by human beings who sometimes make errors. But America does deserve an honest job all the time. And I hope that I am doing that. I think these books are very important that are coming out. I think Harold Weisberg's book, Whitewash, is probably the best of the whole group, including mine.
That treats in detail all or most of the material in the 26 volumes in a very thorough, searching way,
yes,
doesn't it?
Yes, it's a very thorough job.
Well, now, how do these books that are coming out now in the fall and winter of 1966, how do these books differ? How does the criticism differ, if it does in any way, from those books and articles that appeared at the time the Warren Commission report was published or immediately before its appearance?
Well, Epstein, you know, is the only one that actually interviewed members of the commission and staff. I think his book is important because he deals with that aspect of the case that none of the rest of us have touched. Lane is a man that has done considerable work interviewing witnesses in the Dallas area. My book, I feel, I give the background on some of the characters in Dallas who were not witnesses but are still important to this case. And then I also am the one that has dealt in greatest detail with the peripheral deaths that have taken place since the assassination.
Yes.
You know, there are now 17 people who had special knowledge or had the opportunity to have special knowledge who have died. Some of them have been murdered. Others have died under questionable circumstances. And I think they deserve to be more fully investigated by big newspapers who have adequate budgets and by the people at large who must come acquainted with what's going on.
Yes, I noticed in your book, it seems to me it differs from those that have appeared so far, to the degree that it publishes large segments of testimony from the 26 volumes. You have edited them to some degree, but you do present large chunks of testimony from a number of people that I think that we might have overlooked or that the other books have not treated. I mean, just looking at your chapter titles here, you first start out with a meeting at Ruby's apartment, and the second chapter is George Senator. Then you have a chapter on Kilgallen, Cantor, and Armstrong, and Bertha Cheek, who was the sister, I believe, of Earlene Roberts, Oswald's landlady. You have a chapter on Jesse Curry, the Dallas chief of police. And I think that this book deals, therefore, with, it seemed to me in reading it, that you're not dealing with the ballistics evidence of the case. You're not dealing with the number of shots or the shells found or the angle of trajectory of fire or where the shots could have come from. It seems to me that you're dealing with a fascinating area. It's fascinating to me to read, and I must say it's a little disturbing because it goes into an area that the commission apparently in its final report didn't seek to dwell. They confined themselves to other points. And you've brought out some fascinating testimony that I want to ask you about. But returning to this question of responsibility and criticism, I noticed that one of the distinguished members of the California Bar, Paul Fries, has written in the New York University Law Review of the Warren Commission that it was vulnerable because its real task was not to find the truth, but to have appeared to have found the truth. Is that an accurate statement? Mr. Fries, incidentally, agrees with the findings of the commission, but he made that stricture on their work.
Well, I certainly don't think that they found the truth. I think it would have been, they may have gotten away with it had they not printed the 3,000 sets of testimony and exhibits. And the reason that I have printed in my book large chunks of the testimony is to let the American public see some of the amazing things that some of these witnesses said. And many of those amazing things the commission passed over without even a question, without even batting an eye. Some of these witnesses would tell the commission, for example, give them a wrong address of maybe 2 or 3 miles in Dallas, and the commission would go blithely on just like it didn't matter which part of town they were talking about.
Yes.
The testimony of Henry Wade is that of a bumbling, almost illiterate country lawyer, but Wade is not that type of lawyer. When you hear him now on an interview, and he's coherent, and he knows what his subject is, and he gets it across to the people in a professional manner.
Did he present a picture of himself to the Warren Commission that doesn't correspond to the man you know in Dallas today?
Yes, I was in law school with him, and I'm one of those who did not graduate from law school, but I was in law school with him, and I know that he's not the type of bungling man that you read in his testimony in the exhibits.
One gets the feeling in reading your book, and on the basis of the selection that you've made of the testimony, that that there was a kind of connivance on the part of the Dallas police, or a kind of involvement in the assassination. How would you characterize it? Am I accurate in saying that? What is your...
Yes, that's an accurate evaluation of what I was trying to do. I think when the most important prisoner in history is, while handcuffed to a policeman with 70 other policemen hanging around, and then that prisoner is killed in the jail by one of the police flunkies, by a hanger-on, by a man that was known to all of the police, by a man that licked the boots of the police in order to stay in business. business, I think we must conclude that the police were involved. And I tried to point out some of the people that I feel were involved with the police.
You have a chapter, I believe it's Thayer Waldo is the witness testifying before the Warren Commission. And he's being interrogated by one of the counsel. In the book, he speaks of the phlegmatic poise of a Lieutenant Butler through the first 2 or 3 days of the assassination, that is on Friday and Saturday. But on Sunday, the day that Ruby shot Oswald, he loses what Waldo calls this phlegmatic poise. You deduce something from this. I wonder if you'd go into that.
Well, Waldo was a working newsman that day. You see, I was an invited newsman to the luncheon that day and did not have...
You were waiting at the Trademark.
I was waiting at the Trademark with hundreds of other newsmen who were invited guests and not working newsmen that day. So I did not cover the assassination or those 2 or 3 days. I spent most of my time crying, but I have interviewed Waldo since, and I have read his testimony a half a dozen times. I went to Mexico City to interview him rather recently, and Waldo told me that although other people said they were in charge of security on this fatal Sunday morning, Waldo said that Butler was in charge of security that morning, and that Butler's bearing, his attitude, his nervous condition that morning was indicative to Waldo that Butler knew something was fixing to take place. And he completely lost the stolid composure that he had presented to Waldo from Friday at 2 o'clock until this Sunday morning.
I see.
So that we feel that Butler was one of the important witnesses that was not even called.
He was not called.
He was not called to testify in any way to the Warren Commission or give a deposition on it.
You had known of Butler.
Yes, I
in Midlothian, according to your book.
Yes, Lieutenant Butler came to Midlothian, which is a small town 25 miles out of Dallas.
That's where you publish your weekly newspaper.
Yes. And he was down there speaking in 1961 and possibly late 61 and possibly 62, making John Birch type speeches. He's a member of the John Birch Society, and he came into my office on one of these visits down to Midlothian, and he knew nothing about me at that time, and his object for visiting my shop was to see if I would print for his group, and I don't know who that group is, but he wanted me to print a region-wide KKK newspaper. Here's a little weekly shop that's been struggling for 20 years trying to make ends meet, and then we have to turn down a big piece of commercial printing that would have put us in good shape economically for quite a while.
Well, hadn't you by then achieved some notoriety in Midlothian? I noticed that you were a recipient in 1963 of the Elijah Parrish Lovejoy Award for Courage in Journalism. I believe that's given by the Southern Illinois University.
That's true, but this encounter with Butler was before of this happened. My place was firebombed in April of 1962, and that's when we got national published. That's the first time anyone ever heard of the little weekly editor from Midlothian, Texas, and Southern Illinois University did give us the award after that incident. But the encounter with Butler was before any of this took place.
I hope you enjoyed part one of this 1966 interview with Penny Jones Jr. We'll pick up part two next week. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, and it's on sale. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. Please email any questions you would like for us to cover in a future podcast. Like I stated earlier, we're going to do a new segment on the podcast where we answer listeners' questions that have emailed in to me. So get your questions ready and we'll try to answer them the best we can. We'll see you next week.